Livermore Lab opened in 1952. It's one of the two places where all of the nuclear weapons in our arsenal were designed, the other being Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico. I wanted to show you this pie chart, because often when you, if you look at the lab's website or see their press releases, you wouldn't hardly know they do nuclear weapons work. But this pie chart, which I realize is hard to see, but you probably can see this big blue area, this is the total budget that they get and for fiscal year 2013 from the Department of Energy. And the blue part is their nuclear weapons activities. So it still makes up 88% of the budget at the lab, which is approximately $1 billion a year out of the $1.125 billion budget. Tri-Valley Cares has been monitoring the lab since 1983. It's actually our 30th anniversary this year, we're happy to say. If you are new to Tri-Valley Cares, you can grab one of our special Tri-Valley Cares brochures, which are on the table. And we're, of course, a nuclear watchdog, and we also have a website, www.trivalleycares.org. So our first speaker tonight is going to be Mary Leah Kelly. Mary Leah moved to Livermore in 1976 with her son, and unbeknownst to her, she moved just a few blocks away from Lawrence Livermore National Lab. In 1983, after living here for a few years, she met some other concerned citizens and started Tri-Valley Cares. And she's been working on this issue ever since. She's helped the group grow from a fledgling few who would meet once a month at a neighbor's kitchen to one with over 5,600 members, and the credibility and consistency to influence decision-making on a national scale. Mary Leah's testified on behalf of Tri-Valley Cares before California Legislature and the U.S. Congress House Armed Services Committee. She's written for numerous publications, including the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and she's also the editor of and writes for our own newsletter, Tri-Valley Cares Citizens Watch, which you can sign up to receive, and we have some back issues there on the table as well. Mary Leah in 2002 was inducted into the Alameda County Women's Hall of Fame, and she's just an all-around great leader of the group. I'm happy to work for her. She's really working for peace and the justice for this community, and we're lucky to have her. So I give you Mary Leah Kelly.
Thank you. And now we'll go from the tall to the not so tall and hope this doesn't fall out. So let me know if I'm too loud or if I'm too soft, please. My job on the panel tonight is very specific. It's to describe the security change at Livermore Lab and explain some of the basic salient facts about this dangerous proposal to transport full plutonium bomb cores from Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico to Livermore Lab for what they call shake and bake testing, and then to put the bomb cores back on the road again to New Mexico. So let me start by describing the security situation and the change at Livermore Lab. On September 30th, 2012, so September 30th of last year, Livermore Lab permanently lost its security authorization to handle, store, or use bomb-usable quantities of plutonium. So that, of course, includes full bomb cores. That's a bomb-usable quantity of plutonium. At that time, Livermore Lab, so the bureaucratic change, changed from what's called a Category 1/2 security infrastructure to a lesser Category 3 security posture, which, as I said, doesn't allow any bomb-usable quantities of plutonium on site. So at that time, the lab laid off or reassigned more than 100 security personnel. And based on my interviews, the change to Category 3 security also involved the removal of the Gatling guns and other high-tech weaponry from the laboratory. Moreover, the training requirements for Security 3 are different than the training for Security 1/2. So the training for the officers changed at the same time. And this is important, and I'm emphasizing it, because it means that the change was deep and permanent. The Department of Energy and NSA cannot wave a wand over it and do what they're presently proposing, which is create security variances from time to time and bring full plutonium bomb cores here to Livermore Lab. That would be a very dangerous situation. Interestingly, both Tri-Valley CARES and the Department of Energy National Nuclear Security Administration heralded the reduction in security and the removal of the plutonium, albeit for different reasons. We in Tri-Valley CARES had been working for years to stop dangerous plutonium activities at Livermore Lab. And in 2008, Tri-Valley CARES investigated and then publicized that Livermore Lab had massively failed a force-on-force security drill. So this is a drill where DOE headquarters folks came out, and they were able to access the plutonium at Livermore Lab. One team of mock terrorists was able to hold their ground and detonate a radiological device, a mock one, you know, here in Livermore. And another team was able to steal the material and leave the site. You cannot fail security any more massively than that. We launched a petition drive to give the community a voice. And so we had volunteers at local supermarkets, at farmers markets, and other venues. And we gathered more than 13,000 signatures on our petition. And this combination of research, outreach, organizing, and advocacy helped create the atmosphere in which the final decision was irrevocably made to remove the bomb-usable quantities of plutonium from Livermore and reduce the security infrastructure. So this success in getting the plutonium out of Livermore and getting the security infrastructure lowered is part of our inspiration for now, 4 years later, 5 years later, launching a new petition drive on the, well, as it says, to prevent the transport of plutonium bomb cores back and forth between Los Alamos, New Mexico, and Livermore, California. So we have copies of this petition in English and Spanish on the table and on our website. So for the NNSA, National Nuclear Security Administration, I'm just going to call them DOE NNSA from now on. I hope that's okay. They also celebrated. The agency put out a press release on September 21st, 2012, 9 days before the security change came into effect, stating that the last of the bomb-usable quantities of plutonium had been removed from the lab. And the head of NNSA at the time, Tom D'Agostino, characterized the removal of the special nuclear material as saving taxpayer money. Please try to remember these two things because I'm going to come back to them. We were going to save taxpayer money, he said, and we were going to improve safety and security at the site, at the lab. So on one level, that change in lowering security is progress. And we celebrate it as a milestone in constraining Livermore Lab's nuclear weapon design capabilities. However, here's the problem that we all face today. The U.S. Department of Energy, NNSA, which owns Livermore Lab, Los Alamos Lab, and the nuclear weapons complex, left a suite of bomb core diagnostics in Livermore in one bay of Livermore Labs Building 334, which sits near the main facility in the super block, the main plutonium facility is Building 332. So in a sense, they took the plutonium, the bomb-usable quantities, left only smaller quantities, but they left the diagnostics. So you've got a situation where the Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico, which produces the plutonium bomb cores, does not have this diagnostic. Never had it, doesn't have it today. And Livermore Lab does not have the security infrastructure anymore to safely and securely handle the plutonium bomb cores, which are also called pits because they sit inside the bomb the way an apricot pit sits inside an apricot. So I try to say bomb cores, but sometimes I'll revert to saying pits because that's what they're usually called. So I talk to a lot of DOE people in Washington, D.C., and a lot of other government agencies and members of Congress and congressional staff. And what the proposal is currently on the books is to bring those plutonium pits from New Mexico to California to utilize the shake and bake. It's not a final decision, but it is the plan. I want to talk a little bit about those diagnostics. They consist of, there are three basically. One is called the shaker table, so that you put the plutonium bomb core on and vibrate the shit out of it. And one is called a thermal unit, that's the bake and shake and bake. And one is a drop test, where I'll read a little bit about the drop test. These tests are intended to demonstrate how the nuclear bomb cores will perform in a storage, transportation, or use environment. And yes, use environment means what you think it means, nuclear war, to use them. Here is some language from the Labs magazine describing the drop test part of the diagnostic. So I wanted to read a little bit of it to you so you'd hear Livermore Labs' own words. But remember, this article is from before they lost their security. I have a bunch of documents, but I won't have time to refer to all of them, but I'll try a couple here. So this is what it says. Mach high explosive is wrapped around a plutonium pit. So note, it's the whole plutonium bomb core. Around a plutonium pit inside an aluminum case. The case has flanges that simulate the mounting to a warhead case. It is mounted to the test fixture, which in turn is mounted to the drop machine's carriage. When the test unit is dropped, the speed of its fall usually depends on gravity. Although in the case of testing the Los Alamos' B-61, carefully arranged bungee cords pull the test fixture downward to create acceleration of velocities greater than those that could be achieved by gravity. The unit comes down onto a chunk of steel. And it even has pictures of them affixing the bungee cords to a real plutonium bomb core. So a final thing I want to say about shake and bake is that there was a recent Office of the Inspector General report that stated that these diagnostics at Livermore were not in use between 2005 and 2011. And in 2011, NNSA made a decision to use them for the W76 life extension program. And Jay is going to speak more about the nuclear weapons policy choices that are at stake here. But I want to mention this fact because one solution would be for the DOE and NSA to make a final decision not to ever use these diagnostics, period, to mothball them, to decommission them. However, that is not what's happening. You should know that a recent Government Accountability Office report states that NNSA, and I want to look at this so that I read the quote correctly, intends to, quote unquote, maintain this pit testing capability, and that, quote, NNSA currently has no final plans for relocating them elsewhere. So if, for those who don't know, the GAO is the investigative arm of the US Congress. And basically what they're saying is the government plans to do these plutonium bomb core tests, and currently they have no final plan to move the diagnostics, which means they plan to do it here. One of the many questions I asked numerous Obama administration officials is how often these tests would be conducted. Since there's no environmental impact statement, there are no bounds to the proposal. So I said, how often? And it's left vague and amorphous. And essentially, I was told that the number is unknown and that it could vary greatly depending on the nuclear weapon campaigns going on that particular year. One official did suggest that the bomb corps could come to Livermore about 6 times a year. So I have only a few minutes left, and I've described a little bit about the bomb corps tests, and I think I should also briefly describe the transportation. I can say for certain that these plutonium pits would be put on trucks at Los Alamos. While the government doesn't publicize the routes for moving classified bomb corps, the most likely and the shortest route runs through Santa Fe and Albuquerque, New Mexico, across Flagstaff, Arizona, across to the Barstow-Bakersfield Highway, and then up I-5, up through the spine of California to 580 through Tracy into Livermore. That route is 1,136 miles. I need about two. There are two other possible routes, and both of them are longer, and both of them would go through even more populated areas. And I want to just highlight that, again, once the tests in Livermore are completed, those bomb corps are put back on the trucks, put on the road again. They go 1,136 miles back to Los Alamos. So this proposal doesn't make any of us safer. And I want to go back to what Tom D'Agostino said about saving the taxpayer money. It would be very expensive to move plutonium bomb corps back and forth across the country. And it's the opposite of making Livermore more safe and secure. It puts us at a very severe and extreme risk, potentially catastrophic risk. The lab management appears to be placing its bomb testing desires above public safety. Moreover, the DOE is exercising poor planning and leaving the diagnostics behind. The bottom line for me is that communities should not be put in danger because Livermore Lab has plutonium envy, and DOE has an abysmal lack of foresight. Therefore, a central part of our demand is that they must either permanently decommission the diagnostics, and this is preferable, or move the diagnostics to where the bomb corps are located. So I'm going to try to cut this part down, but essentially, a relevant fact here is that in 2008, some of you remember the Complex Transformation Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement and the public hearings. And the DOE made a decision, which it codified in a record of decision, to move these diagnostics at that time to Pantex in Texas, where most of the pits are. But it didn't move them. It didn't move them. It left them here. I think it's because in 2008, they hadn't used them since 2005. Remember, they didn't use them between 2005 and 2011. And Livermore had Category 1 and 2 security then. So they're still here. They didn't move them, even though the environmental impact statement called the impact inconsequential. So there are options. The best option is to decommission the diagnostics. In the alternative, they could move the diagnostics to Pantex or to Los Alamos, where the pits are. One final note, though, is Tri-Valley Cares believes that none of these alternatives should be done willy-nilly, the way they're doing it now, with this vague, amorphous plan. The DOE is about 3 months behind in producing a formal written plan for Congress. Let me tell you, Congress was pretty upset when I was there in mid-January. They're supposed to be detailing their future plutonium strategy. So before they make any decision, we believe they must do a full environmental impact statement, and they must have public hearings, and they must involve the public at any of the sites, whether it's along a transportation route here at Livermore, at Los Alamos, at Pantex, depending on what they decide. They have to make sure that all the directly affected people are part of that decision and are heard. Scott's going to talk more about the legal process, so you'll hear that from him. And before that, though, we're going to turn it over to Jay to talk about the New Mexico perspective and policy implications.
Mm-hmm. Tara. I'm a board member of Tri-Valley Cares. I'm going to be co-facilitating with Scott tonight, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you all Jay Coughlin. He is the executive director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico, and he's worked on Department of Energy, nuclear weapons, and environmental issues for over 22 years. He was recognized as the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability's Grassroots Advocate of the Year in 2003. And amongst many other accomplishments, he actually conceived of Senator Jeff Bingaman's legislative mandate for an independent review of plutonium pit lifetime studies. And this November 2006 conclusion that pits last a century or more, they don't really go bad, has seriously undermined the National Nuclear Security Administration's aggressive proposal for new weapons designs and expanded pit production. So all the way from New Mexico, we're lucky to have Jay Coughlin. Welcome.
Well, thank you all for having me here. And I guess the first thing I want to make clear is that great personal cost that I'm here to speak at you with y'all. I'm a pretty serious skier. Taos Ski Valley had 28 fresh inches today. And, you know, it's the beautiful bluebird skies of northern New Mexico, turquoise skies. So, first of all, I want to elicit a lot of sympathy in that y'all share my pain. And then from there, you know, I'll go on with more fatuous statements. But Mary Lee and myself, well, actually, you know, I'm pushing not 22 years, but like 25 years, which sounds scary. It's, you know, a quarter century of doing this stuff. But Mary Lee and I, we've had kind of a friendly rivalry for that time over who has the biggest and baddest lab. And I get macho about it, and she gets matcha about it. And, you know, just going by the money and size, Los Alamos, you know, is clearly the biggest and baddest, roughly double the money, 37 square miles versus this puny one square mile here, et cetera, et cetera. But then Mary Lee's touche.
Give the microphone back.
But Mary Lee's touche is always, well, but Livermore is running Los Alamos. And that's actually true, at least in the sense that the last two directors of Los Alamos have come out of Livermore nuclear weapons programs. And so there's always been this funny thing between the two laboratories, the old saying, and I understand that the laboratories said this about each other, so you can switch the positions, but Los Alamos used to always say that the Soviet Union was the adversary, but Livermore was the enemy. And so it'd be vice versa here. And another anecdote towards that end, I used to do a lot of rock climbing, and one of my main climbing partners was a kid that grew up in Los Alamos, but and his father was pretty senior at Los Alamos. But he told me something like in the middle 60s, I guess it'd be, that some kids from Livermore moved in on their residential block, and his parents told him not to play with the Livermore kids. So you can imagine that. But it's probably time for me to get down to serious business, but I would like to note, Mary Lee and I, we end up in meetings in Washington quite a bit. In fact, we just had a series of them 2 weeks ago. I want you all to know that you have a terrific leader here, a very effective woman. I'm trying to make her blush, and maybe, yeah, okay, but y'all should know that, and that she's very much, has a national reputation, et cetera, balances out, helps to balance out the grassroots interests with the interests of the more conventional arms control organizations in Washington, and that in and of itself is a long story that we won't get into here. But y'all have a good one, and she's been at it for a long time, is very effective. And then while I'm on this subject though, I also want to recognize Jackie Cabasas. who is modestly sitting there in the middle, but stand up and take a bow, Jackie. You know, been with Western States Legal Foundation. And they're celebrating their 30th anniversary next week. So you all have some terrific people here in the greater Bay area. Now, to finally get down to business here, and I trust that Tara will mind the time, because I can keep going on if the spirit so moves me. But regarding this business of shipping plutonium back and forth to Los Alamos, I noted with interest that Mary Leah said that they hadn't been doing this since 2005. And now all of a sudden they are, or at least they proclaim that they are. And the situation is currently conflicted, and I'm going to intentionally, right now, for the sake of discussion, adopt the rosy glasses view. But Mary Leah, you were telling me and others that basically this forum prompted a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle to call NNSA, the National...
Did not want to be mentioned by name. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't mention names. Okay.
All right.
Good thing. It was a reporter from somewhere that called the National Nuclear Security Administration, but... Reportedly, the reporter said that NNSA said, "Oh no, we're not shipping pits to Livermore." So perhaps one thing we should do right here, right now, as we do our strategizing, is simply declare victory and note this and make sure it gets recorded and we've already won. And towards that end, I really want to stress that sometimes in this business, we are handed relatively easy victories. And I just sense that this is one. And one that can actually have profound implications, both nationally and even internationally. And of course, you know, just to be explicit, so there's no confusion, what I mean is stopping these shipments of plutonium back and forth from Los Alamos to Livermore. And I want to suggest again that this has potentially profound implications. I think the real purpose of these shipments to Livermore is to keep this laboratory in the nuclear weapons game. And I actually, as a token member of the male gender, I like this phrase plutonium envy, and I think I think it's a serious matter. Is these lab boys here at Livermore, they're going to start getting an advanced case of plutonium envy here, and they lose their credibility in this nuclear weapons game if they don't have. Their plutonium. Now I want to check with the timekeeper. She just held up 5 minutes, and that means that I just took 5 minutes and have 10 more to go, right? Five to go. Okay. So anyway, to repeat myself and to underline what I regard the reason why this is so very, very important, I like to make fun of the Department of Energy, which is not hard to do, and I'm a believer in take your fun where you find it. But sometimes it's never clear to me what may be malicious intent or sheer incompetence on their part. And so we have this conflict where just 2 weeks ago, Mary Leah and I personally heard the head of nuclear weapons programs within the Department of Energy, we discussed these plutonium shipments. So, you know, this is clearly being planned at the highest levels. Whereas, on the other hand, we have this, what I assume is a local NNSA official saying they're not happening.
It was DOE Albuquerque.
Oh.
It was your guy.
My guy. Okay. Well, I'll speak to him on the way back. But again, y'all can win this one. And And for the third time, I'm pointing to the underlying profundity of this issue, or why winning this would be so important. And I was starting to say that I like to make fun of the Department of Energy. I'm trying to fold in this multi-billion dollar failure known as the National Ignition Facility that is now, it's racking up nearly $8 billion, the bill, the cost. And I think that Tri-Valley Cares and others have referred to it as the National Almost Ignition Facility because it's almost getting near ignition, and you have to take some joy in appropriate or humorous acronyms when one can, and we have to deal with acronyms a lot. But I like the National Almost Ignition Facility, NAIF, and you know they've been playing us for fools for years now, promising ignition and just plowing through the money. But the combination of this spectacular failure with the National Ignition Facility, that whose funding base is nuclear weapons programs, and it can only have now very limited relevancy to so-called stockpile stewardship. So given that failure, and if you all here can couple that with stopping these plutonium pit shipments to Livermore, you essentially are left with a laboratory that doesn't merit being funded by nuclear weapons programs. And, you know, I'm looking at this poster now, this Tri-Valley Cares poster, and, you know, you're talking no nukes and you're talking convert Livermore. Now, that's good rhetoric, and basically that's what I think it is rhetoric. But I know that people like Mary Leah and folks like you helping her, you can get down in the trenches and actually make that happen. You can actually make that happen. And then I'm going to close now before Tara brings out the hook or, you know, whatever. I kind of entered being an activist through the back door. And for me to become an activist was really to re-enter back into society. So I guess that says something about myself. But in any event, I feel that one of my jobs as an activist is to promote others to be active. And, you know, I'll be, my family would quickly agree with me that I'm nobody special. I mean, that's a fact. But I want to go on to say that I have been amazed by the impact that I personally have had. And I'm amazed by the impact that Mary Leah has had. I'm amazed by the impact that Jackie has had. I'm amazed by the impact that activists can have if you get off your butts and you actually get up, you go to Congress, and never, never forget that democracy is a muscle and you gotta use it or lose it. But I don't want to hear apathy. I hear this constantly. I hear it from my own kids, etc., that, oh, we can't do anything. You sure can't if you don't get off your butts, that by definition. I like the, I'm going to close now, and I know I have to quote, have to actually quit when I could go on. But I want to quote the immortal hockey great, Wayne Gretzky. And what does he have to do with talking about plutonium? But anyway, the quote is, you know what? You miss 100% of the shots you never take. So the answer is get out on the ice and take the shot. And you all here in this room, you can stop these plutonium shipments to Livermore and thereby change the course of nuclear weapons policies, not only nationally, but internationally as well. So there you go. Hope you all do it.
Thank you, Jay. So next we're going to have Peter Strauss. Peter Strauss has been working with Tri-Valley Cares since 1991 as a technical advisor on the environmental cleanup of Livermore Lab's main site. In the mid-90s, he was awarded a second contract to analyze data and advise Tri-Valley CARES on the cleanup at Livermore Lab Site 300, which is the high explosives testing range that's in the hills between Livermore and Tracy. His responsibilities include providing detailed analysis of reports, monitoring well logs and other technical data on soil and groundwater contaminants and their migration through the environment. Peter also provides the group with comparative analysis of potential or selected remediation technologies and assists with preparation of writing comments on the Superfund process. He authored Tri-Valley CARES Community Guide to the Site 300 cleanup and its comparison guide to the lab's main site cleanup. He's completed a comprehensive study of plutonium problems at Livermore Lab, and he is an all-around expert. He comes on tours with us of the lab and is a great help in analyzing all of the issues facing cleanup as we move on from here. So he's going to talk to us about some of these issues. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Scott. Did anybody leave their notes up here?
Yeah.
Yes, because I don't want to get the same speech. You know, I'm here at a great personal sacrifice as well. I mean, this is my poker night.
This is the whining night.
You know, for this group, I don't need to tell anybody about the toll on the environment of nuclear weapons development. We've contaminated large swaths of this nation. And I want to take this opportunity, because I'm talking about cleanup, but I want to take this opportunity to focus a little bit on the potential pit problem, transfer. You know, that in each new experiment and test in the transfer of radioactive materials across the highways, comes with an environmental cost that's hard to predict, but it's ever present, and it's real. And when I first heard about this, are they going to do some environmental impact statements? And I don't even know if they're going to do that. So that's a... Yeah. So the research and design of nuclear weapons components at Livermore and its satellite site, Site 300, have contaminated the air, the drinking water, the soil, with a soup of chemical and radioactive contaminants. These two sites are not the worst in the nuclear legacy. Yet, both sites are on the national priorities list, which is otherwise known as the Superfund. So I'll try to describe some of the challenges that we face in cleanup here. I'll focus on only the Livermore site, although Site 300 is just as challenging. And I'll focus here on this site because it's facing some critical, it's a juncture where it's facing some critical decisions. The lab has been operating soil and groundwater treatment facilities for designed to contain and remove contaminant mass for 20 plus years. Releases of contaminants are mainly due to inadequate procedures, failed mechanisms that were supposed to prevent those releases, as well as accidental releases and just plain carelessness. The lab and its environmental staff have used as its primary cleanup process, its primary cleanup process is known as pump and treat. That is, you pump water up to the surface, you remove the contaminants, and you discharge the water. At present, we face two new problems that have made the cleanup more difficult and potentially more expensive. And I say potentially more expensive because it's potentially less expensive also. The first is the problem of mixed waste. I don't know if anybody knows what mixed waste means in the legal sense, but it's the combination of a chemical and radioactive waste. We have tritium in the groundwater at this site, and at some of the same locations as we have chemicals. So by trying to bring the groundwater up, we are also bringing up treated water. We try to isolate them in certain ways, but that has then been unsuccessful. And right now we have these carbon canisters that filter out the waste that are also contaminated with tritium. And they're sitting around, they're very expensive to dispose. The Department of Energy in 1995 estimated the life cycle cost of low-level mixed waste was $13 billion for the entire complex. I might get through this. Yeah, the second problem is a function of diminishing returns. Over 20 years of active remediation, the lab has been able to remove much of the easily accessible contaminants. Now, because of the contaminants are more difficult to access, pump and treat is not very cost effective. And Tara, could you and don't take time off my thing. that curve that you see on that chart is called an asymptotic curve. The y-axis represents mass removed. The x-axis represents time or money.
You got it? Okay.
Can everybody see that? So at year one, we see that there is a very high mass removed. And as you go down that curve, it tends to flatten out. And the pump and treat becomes less effective. I don't know exactly where we are in that curve, but I know we're sort of at that curve point where things are flattening out. There have been noticeable declines in our ability to clean up using the pump and treat method. So appropriately, the lab has embarked on trying different approaches to getting these hard-to-access chemicals cleaned up. One is injecting something called zero-valent iron, which really breaks the bonds of the chlorinated solvents and turns that into chlorine and ethane, and it's relatively harmless. Another is enhancing the biological systems that break down the chlorinated solvents, providing the bacteria with food so the community can flourish, or if there is no community there, injecting a bacteria that can break down these products. And that's known as bioaugmentation. Each of these methods have been successfully tested and demonstrated around the country. There's only one big problem. Because of the dense soil and clay, it is increasingly difficult to get the injected material into contact with either the bacteria that you're trying to feed or the contaminant that you're targeting. The lab is testing an approach called pneumatic fracturing to enhance the injected substance's ability to reach its target. So pneumatic fracturing is a process that involves injection of highly pressurized air into consolidated soils to create a network of fissures and cracks. This fracture network is then filled with sand to prop it up or some other substance. So far, tests have been shallow and away from structures and subsurface infrastructure. On one occasion, because of a nearby well, nearby monitoring well, was not properly completed. That is, that it was not properly bonded to the subsurface. They saw that sand and this guar gum came up through the surface as they injected that fluid to prop open the fractures. Although not as controversial as the fracking, I'm almost going to be there. I'm going to make it. As fracking used by industry to extract gas from shale, there are some concerns, including damaging underground infrastructure, damaging foundations, and I might add, in the sensitive structures and equipments in buildings. If you have a lab with lasers and you have pneumatic fracturing, you might have to shut it off. At Moffett Field, NASA did not put a kibosh on pneumatic fracturing because of they have a wind tunnel that's operating. You can spread contaminants that in places that are undesirable, that you don't know where they're going to go. And lastly, there's some concern about fracturing close to the numerous earthquake faults in this area. The lab is now at a crossroad in terms of cleanup decisions. It can choose to continue the same methods with little hope that it will reach remediation goals in your children's lifetime. I mean, that would be if you extend that curve all the way out and they just continue to pump and treat. Or they can invest in innovative approaches to remove contaminants in the subsurface and groundwater. We support, at least I do, support the latter approach, although approaches they carry with it some risk. The lab has initiated experiments, and we encourage it to do more experiments. It is likely to take several years until they make a decision on what the proper mix is, so stay tuned and stay involved. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce Scott Yunt. He is the staff attorney at Tri-Valley Cares, and Scott manages the group's Community Right to Know and environmental programs, and he has brought federal litigation on Tri-Valley Cares' behalf under the Freedom of Information Act and the National Environmental Policy Act. And yeah, Scott is just a really amazing, not only lawyer, but all-around activist, and definitely lucky to have him here in the community in Livermore working on behalf of Tri-Valley Cares. So welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Tara. Happy to be here. nice to be introduced by a close friend. So I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about the National Environmental Policy Act, an act that's really crucial to democracy and really important to the way our country works. However, not very many people really know about it. It's really our basic national charter for the protection of the environment. And it didn't come into law until 1970. And really, other than communicating directly with our congressional representatives and senators, like Jay was talking about, it's the only other way to have public participation and in input into federal decision making before an action is taken. NEPA's enactment was a recognition on behalf of the legislature that early input into agency planning is essential to public participation in democracy. But so far, the NNSA has not conducted any NEPA analysis of the potential impacts on the environment of the shipments of plutonium, as we believe is definitely required. And we did recently receive a response to a letter that Tri-Valley Care sent, and we had 46 co-signers, groups from around the country, asking the NNSA many questions, one of which was, are you going to perform a NEPA analysis of this plan? And in their response, the one thing that they did respond to was that question, and they said they planned on performing a NEPA review. So it's important that we talk a little bit about what that could entail, what we should look for, and how we want to participate in that as a community. So the best analysis you can get from the National Environmental Policy Act, the most thorough, in-depth review, is called an environmental impact statement. And it's required when there's a major federal action with the potential to have a significant impact on the human environment. So due to the obvious potential in this proposal to have an impact on the environment, a significant impact in the case of an accident or malicious incident, the agency should be preparing a full environmental impact statement that analyzes the proposal. However, there are more cursory NEPA review options the agency could opt for, and if they believe that there isn't going to be a significant impact. One is called an environmental assessment, which is a document that analyzes the potential, but in a brief statement, and it's supposed to decide whether or not a full environmental impact statement is necessary. If they decide it is, then they could also go forward and then do an environmental impact statement after the environmental assessment. If they decide that it's not going to have a significant impact, they released what's known as a FONSI, or a finding of no significant impact, which means they're not going to do an environmental impact statement. So I made a handout, too, just so people know. It's on the table. It's blue. It looks like this. It's kind of a basic guide to the NEPA process. So if you're interested in this, please grab one. I wanted to talk a little bit about what the contents of an environmental impact statement are, because it's important for us to know if what we're going to get if we get a full environmental impact statement. So it would include the environmental impact of the proposed action. So this would include traditional environmental issues like the impact on species, the impact on groundwater, the impact on air quality. But it also actually includes things that we don't traditionally view as environmental, because the act includes the human environment. So it would include things like an analysis of transportation, of economics, of the economic impact of something. It would include analysis of the threat of a terrorist attack, even. A full EIS would also analyze any adverse environmental effects which can't be avoided. So that's kind of similar to the first one. More importantly, it would analyze all reasonable alternatives to the proposed action. And this is crucial in this particular instance because, as Mary Leah very eloquently stated, there are some clear alternatives to this plan that make a lot of sense. And if the lab does a NEPA analysis, which it has said it would, they're going to have to explain why those alternatives are not preferred. We would hope they would come to the conclusion that those alternatives are preferred, because it's pretty hard to see why they wouldn't be. And when I say preferred, that's actually a legal term. They're forced to pick a preferred alternative in the document, which is kind of an interesting thing, because they pick that alternative and then use the document to kind of explain why that's their preferred alternative. And we get a public participation in the document through comments and even through public hearings if there's a full environmental impact statement, in which we can challenge their preferred alternative if they don't pick the one that we like, or if we think there's true alternatives that are better, or even alternatives that they didn't analyze at all. So the relationship between local short-term uses of the environment and the long-term productivity of the environment also have to be analyzed, and any irreversible commitment of resources, so government funds or land. If a full EIS is prepared, there will potentially be several opportunities for public input. And there are also many reasons to have this, to make these comments. I kind of mentioned these, but one is to influence the lead agency to modify its proposal to avoid or minimize significant environmental impacts, also to suggest additional reasonable alternatives, and to also give perspectives or information that they didn't consider. You should also comment to urge or convince the lead agency to deny a proposed action or change its course, and more importantly, to lay the groundwork for future judicial challenges. This is especially important to us because if you do think you might have to litigate the issue, they're choosing a preferred alternative, it's pretty clear they're going to go forward with it, you believe the analysis they did is inadequate in some way, you have to comment with all of the relevant material that you would use in a lawsuit. Otherwise, you're not allowed to bring it up in a future lawsuit. It's called exhausting your administrative remedies. So the comments have to be very thorough and cover all of the issues you might bring up in court. So the DOE in this instance, has been planning this proposal without community scrutiny and out of the public eye. And it's Tri-Valley Care's job as your community watchdog organization to shed light on the issue and guide the community through the NEPA review process and do all that we can to change or stop this ill-conceived action. If the agency tries to bring plutonium pits to Livermore without a full EIS analyzing the impacts and without full hearings, Tri-Valley Care's will be forced to bring judicial action and to ensure the safety and security of the community are upheld. Livermore Lab is a national lab. Its actions are done in our name as a federal facility. So together we stand at the crossroad. And either Livermore Lab's going to go full speed ahead with this proposal and its attempts to maintain its status as a full-scale nuclear weapons design laboratory all the way into obsolescence and 20 years after the Cold War has ended, or it can shift roads and focus on a 21st century science pursuit. It can pursue cleanup technologies to clean up the half century of environmental destruction that nuclear weapons development has caused at sites around the country. It can also focus on other civilian science pursuits, like helping communities adapt to climate change, for example. So it's going to take public pressure to change this plutonium shipping proposal, and in doing so, hopefully we will push Livermore Lab that much closer to shifting to a different, more sustainable path. And so this meeting today is the first step in that path.